We're back.
So again, you know, I think the approach to science actually becomes maybe a little bit different in that the quality of the science becomes extremely important. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the numbers of papers that one publishes, but the major advances that one makes over a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. So in the analysis, I think what one has to ask oneself and one, you know, is undergoing review then is, well, over the past 5 years, what are the major advances out of my laboratory that have really advanced our understanding of the biological questions that we have asked? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, well, how many papers have I published? Mm-hmm. And that then, I think, takes it to a new standard. Because most papers, I would say, if you take the compendium of most the average papers out there, really don't add that much to our understanding of biology, mm-hmm. Or the questions that are being asked. That's not to say that they're meaningless. They clearly provide some information, but the amount of information may well be very incremental.
So let me go back to my original question, which is how much time do you spend grant writing?
I spend probably still a significant amount of time in grant writing, but it's hard to average it out, you know, because the NIH grants run every 5 years.
Sure.
So you caught me in the year that, you know, I was writing my renewals, I'd probably be spending a significant amount of time. Mm-hmm. Now, when I write grants, it actually is not that time demanding for me. That's not necessarily because I write it well, but probably because I start early enough.
I see.
You know, I start typically 6 to 7 weeks before the grant is due. And I usually have a first draft within 4 weeks before the grant is due. So then I actually can take it pretty leisurely over the ensuing 2-3 weeks in terms of touching up the grant, getting comments on the grant. So it's not as probably harried a process of many of my colleagues who wait 3 weeks before the grant is due to begin writing the grant. And some people just like to do it that way because they feel that they can work better under pressure. But I just don't like to work it that way. And I think it also depends on how one perceives the grant writing. So again, I have the luxury of having the Hughes. So most of the grants that I write, at least with the Hughes funding, are not the grants that I absolutely have to have. They're grants that would facilitate our being able to do a certain high quality work. But it's not like I'm going to go starving the next day. So from that standpoint, it becomes probably a little bit more of a luxury, okay, and not as much of a drudgery or a pressure situation where I know I absolutely have to get this grant, otherwise, you know, my position at the university becomes tenuous.
Now, I have heard some people say that they feel the pressure not so much for themselves, but they don't want to have to fire anybody. And if they don't, you know, get the grant or get the renewal, they're going to have to let people go, and that feels like a big sort of personal burden.
Well, it is a burden from that standpoint, especially, you know, if you've had people for long periods of time. That becomes problematic. Maybe it's partly St. Louis, but, you know, we have a pretty continued turnover of personnel. So people usually don't necessarily stay in a particular position for more than 5 or 6 years. They decide to go do something else. We hire, you know, people right out of college, and they may want to do this for 2 to 3 years, and they go on want to move on to something else. So I think all those things are true. I mean, I think losing funding or losing a position is a fact of academic life, and people in those positions realize that. For me, it's usually outside of the funding issue, actually, I'm more concerned about whether one of my postdocs or my graduate students who have worked very hard in the project, okay, is going to be able to get that paper published in the best journal possible. Because mm-hmm. in part, my, you know, I have a job already. Mm-hmm. Okay, having this other paper, yes, it would be nice, it would be another feather in the cap. But again, it's, I'm not going to be put in a position whereby I'm not going to have a job if I don't have that paper. Mm-hmm. I may lose certain lines of funding, but it's a, that's mm-hmm. a different story. Whereas for the postdoc, the graduate student, getting that particular paper published is extremely important to them mm-hmm. in terms of their careers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So actually, I have more fear or I have more concerns about those kinds of situations. Than the funding situations.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about paper writing in a minute. Mm-hmm. So, but just to finish up on the grant thing, mm-hmm. has there ever been a time when you thought you might be short of funds, or have you always been in pretty good shape?
Well, by and large, we've been in pretty good shape. There have been times where it was clear that we were overspending what we should be spending. you know, I'd be like, we spent, you know, $10,000 this past week. How did that happen? Uh-huh. But you know, with the Hughes so far, it's been a pretty easy time mm-hmm. to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now the Hughes, I don't know if I'm on the right track here, mm-hmm. but I would call that philanthropic funding, kind of like the Pew is philanthropic funding, as opposed to mm-hmm. the R01s or government funding.
And then, yes, right.
And then there's also the possibility of commercial funding.
Right.
Do you have any commercial funding?
I don't have any commercial funding. I mean, getting commercial funding in combination with the Hughes funding is a huge conflict.
I see.
The Hughes Institute, by and large, does not permit strings attached funding mm-hmm. from commercial sources.
Okay.
You know, if a company wants to give us funds with no strings attached, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But most companies won't do that.
Right.
And again, the degrees of funding, you know, one has to sort of measure what is the payoff in terms of this particular line of funding mm-hmm. versus the amount of work that's required to get that kind of funding, you know. So every week, you know, there's some other internal type of granting or other mm-hmm. external type of funding agency for a total of $20,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, for $20,000 that, you know, I wanted to write 5 even or 10 pages for, it probably is not worth the effort.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, we've been very fortunate because we've had the Hughes. We've been fortunate with mm-hmm. our success in getting extramural funding from the NIH mm-hmm. and other sources mm-hmm. That we, by and large, have not had to worry about those kinds of mm-hmm. factors. You know, that doesn't mean that I still right now keep tabs pretty much on where the money goes.
Mm-hmm.
I have to think about who's being paid off what grant, mm-hmm. who's being, you know,
mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But not so much in terms of where the, you know, finding ourselves $100,000 short here, $100,000 short there.
In terms of what you can do with the money, what are the differences between, say, government and philanthropic mm-hmm. funding?
The Hughes funding basically allows me to do anything I want scientifically. Okay, you know, if tomorrow I decided that I have this phenomenal idea and we're going to study worm development, I can do that. The NIH granting mechanisms have obviously a little bit different of a responsibility or, you know, guiding rate. Because the Hughes, primarily, they just want to see cutting-edge science done.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go back and you work on worms and you come up with some phenomenal discovery, they'll be very, very happy, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a way, the government funding does and does not allow you to do that. Okay, so if you work, if you present a grant in the immune cell system, the immune system, you're expected to be able to finish that particular grant. Now, and if you want to renew it 5 years down the road, well, you better have shown that you have provided out, you know, that you have completed all the things that you propose to do and have been successful and have published papers. And this then becomes extremely subjective in many ways. Because, you know, I've sat in study sections and there's always a debate on productivity of the individual versus the quality of work that the person's done. Some people count papers independent of the quality of papers. Other people say they've made, you know, made significant advances in the field, and big deal, they've only published 3 major papers in the major journals out of this particular grant. And those 3 papers have clearly made greater advances in the field than another grant that has published 40 papers with incremental advances. So this becomes, I mean, there's no hard line here. But nonetheless, I think, you know, the NIH, you're held to much more so in what you propose and whether you've accomplished it or not. Than, for example, other sources. Because actually, you know, even aside from philanthropic, but let's say the American Cancer, American Heart, American Foundation, I mean, the Arthritis Foundation, those particular grants usually are non-renewable. Not all, but most of them are non-renewable. So there is really, from that standpoint, less accountability in terms of, you know, ultimate completion of what one initially proposed. And I think in some ways it's hard. Because it's hard to predict where the science goes. How can I predict every result that's going to happen in the next 5 years and know whether it's interesting or not? If I can predict every result that's going to happen in the next 5 years, odds are the experiment probably is not worth doing. Okay? Because it was must probably be so incremental that I could have predicted what the result was going to be. So I think those are the differences in terms of what one can do and can't do.
Well, it sounds as if the Pew money was kind of a hybrid of those two things, because you were expected to have a proposal, and yet the funds were unrestricted.
I mean, I think that's one really of the beauty of the Pew funds, were that you proposed a particular project based on, you know, obviously what you've done before. And from what I can tell, the selection was, you know, extremely keen, because, you know, the competition between the last 40 individuals were extremely close. I mean, it was very hard. You could, you know, many of the advisors said you could have just flipped a coin. But at the same time, the funds allowed you to take whatever high-risk kinds of experiments that one wanted to do. If you wanted to change the direction of one's science because of a particular opportunity, you had the opportunity to undertake that, you know, that transformation. And I think that's one of the real beauties of science. And that actually is what many times distinguishes an outstanding scientist from a good scientist, is that, you know, you're going down a certain path and you have an unexpected result. And a good scientist will continue going down with the original path. And the outstanding scientist said, will say, hey, this doesn't quite make sense, or this is not what I expected, and totally reroute their thinking in pursuing an entire new direction. Okay, and hopefully it's those kinds of unexpected results that will allow you to make a particular observation. I mean, this has happened to us, for example, my first few years, where we were looking at a particular interaction for one particular project. And as it turned out, it was a total artifact. And at the same time, we were studying an interaction with another protein. And it turned out the first protein was actually the correct one that interacted with the protein involved in the second project. And if you weren't thinking, you wouldn't have tied the two together. And we were lucky that we were able to tie the two together, and the subsequent studies were made very easy, because we already had made all the mutants of the first protein. So I think, you know, one has to be able to redirect one's science, and having the funds to redirect one's science becomes a huge advantage.
Now, in terms of the Pew money, or the Pew scholarship, I'm not which is more than just the money. When that came along, where were you in your career?
So I was, let's see, so I started 94 through 99. So it was my first year as an assistant professor.
Oh, okay. And you already had the Howard Hughes, though, at this point, right? Okay.
Right.
So what, if anything, did it mean to get the Pew?
I mean, I think the major impact that the Pew had scientifically now, I mean, it has a lot of other impacts, but scientifically, was the availability for me to have colleagues that I can discuss issues that I wouldn't discuss with my division chief. I mean, all the things that you don't learn as a postdoc about how do you motivate people, how do you deal with postdocs or students or technicians that spin their wheels, how to focus one's attention. In terms of trying to deal with all the non-scientific issues, but that clearly directly relate to your science, was a huge advantage. Because all of a sudden you realize you weren't alone. All these other people had similar problems. And this is what they tried, and it didn't work. This is what this person tried, and that did work. Okay? So number one, it gave you a perspective of all the problems that one can run into, which are fairly common. Second, the diversity of the science was obviously a huge advantage, because it made me appreciate a variety of the sciences that were not directly, not the science that I typically read or the individual I interact with on a day-to-day basis. So those were clearly two of the major advantages for the Pew scientifically. I mean, there are obviously other things, you know, social policy, scientific leadership, the role of the scientists in terms of the world, all these other issues. One increases their awareness of all these other issues. And I think in the long run, that's going to be important. I mean, the money, per se, is a small chunk of money. It allows one to basically take off on different tangents. So, for example, one of the things that we have done recently is that we were interested in this relatively new methodology of being able to identify proteins using proteomics and large 2D, 2-dimensional gel electrophoresis. And the entire setup, you know, costs about $30,000. I mean, no NIH grant's going to allow you to do that, and even the Hughes funding is not going to allow you to do that on a whim. So, but it wasn't on a whim. You know, it was after months of preparation that we decided this is the way that we were going to do it. And, you know, yes, we could. I could have written for an equipment grant from the NIH, but the problem with equipment grants from the NIH is that it's going to take probably a cycle. You'll get the equipment, if you're lucky, after about a year. I could apply it from the Hughes, but then I may get it in 6 months. Well, I want to do the experiment in the next month. Okay, in 6 months, I may not necessarily want to do the same experiment. So the funds, you know, from the Pew allowed me at least to purchase that equipment to then go in this particular direction. And if it works, it's going to change drastically the way that we pursue our science probably for the next 5 to 10 years. So it's having the opportunity to be able to do that. That is the huge advantage.
Now, in terms of, you know, this kind of sharing ideas about lab management and science and that sort of thing, was that what happened at meetings? Because, you know, everyone loves the Pew meetings.
Right. That's,
or did you actually find yourself communicating at other times? Yeah. With people?
It's predominantly at the meetings. I would say probably 80% of the discussions are there.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But out of those meetings, you know, you develop a certain relationship with a small number of individuals.
Uh-huh.
And over the years, you know, I may have some crazy idea, or I have a question about a field that I had no little in,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just lazy, and I don't want to go and investigate the entire 10 years of literature.
Right.
So then I just email so-and-so, and I say, listen, this is the crazy idea I have.
Uh-huh.
What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just a few weeks ago, I noticed that, you know, one of the genes that we had a particular sequence that one of the other Pew scholars actually wrote a paper in 1986 on, and subsequently a review in 1996. So I just ended up calling him and said, hey, this is, you know, Andy. Yeah, yeah, how's everything going? Oh, it's fine. You know,
yeah,
hey, this and that. You're the expert in this field. What do you think about so-and-so? So the networking also is advantageous, you know, during the year outside of the Pew meetings.
Because,
you know, these people know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they wouldn't be any less agreeable if I wasn't a Pew scholar.
Mm-hmm.
But you've already established a certain relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make you any smarter or any less smart, but you know they've seen you as a person, which may be good or bad. And in any case, I think it allows one to just get on the phone and say, "Hey, what do you think?"
Mm-hmm.
And just bouncing certain ideas off other people who are experts and have a different view on it actually is very, very valuable and very helpful. And whether anything comes of it, you know, it's a different story.
Okay.
So the Pew has, you know, there are multiple facets of the Pew program that I think have enriched my scientific life, my view of science and the world, my view of my colleagues, and my appreciation of all of those.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, as I promised you, we'd come back to writing papers. And actually, let me pause for just a second. Okay, we're back. And actually, because of some time constraints, we're going to leave writing for tomorrow.
Okay.
And let's just talk briefly about lab management, which is something else you're not trained for before you have to do it. And you talked about it just briefly before about how do you motivate people and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, who's in your lab?
Yeah.
How big is your lab?
So my lab right now, it's usually around a dozen people, myself included. Which includes usually anywhere from 2 to 3 students. So I have 2 thesis students and usually 1 to 2 rotating graduate students. There are 4 postdocs, and there are 4 technicians.
Okay, that's a pretty good size.
So that's about the size I like it, because that's the only way I can't keep track of more projects than that.
Okay.
And the way that I run the lab is from a day-to-day level, I meet with my graduate students once a week.
Okay.
Formally.
Okay.
So I set aside 1.5 hours to meet with them to discuss their data. And I tell them, you know, the meeting may last 5 minutes, the meeting may last 1.5 hours or longer.
An hour and a half each one.
Each one.
So that's 6 hours a week that you spend meeting with?
With just the students.
Okay.
I also block off 1.5 hours for the technicians. For
each technician.
For each technician.
Okay.
So during that, and usually the meetings don't usually run 1.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they run maybe 1 hour,
mm-hmm.
Depending what need is that particular week. Sometimes it may only last 5 minutes if we really don't have anything to discuss.
Okay.
But I think it's important because it blocks off that 1.5 hours and tells a student, if you have anything to discuss, you don't want to talk about science, you want to talk about what you want to do as a postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about what your future is going to be like 25 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
You have that 1.5 hours of my undivided attention.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to set aside time to be able to discuss those kinds of issues.
Okay.
You know, we don't. Most of the time, it's basically just going over the data, figuring out what kind of experiments need to go over next, mm-hmm. what try to troubleshoot for the student, what things you can try to do to clean up all these dirty gels, mm-hmm. Dirty blots, you know, why a certain type of ligation of molecular biology is not working, how to interpret the data and things like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And then I meet with my postdocs once every 2 to 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Again, the same kind of hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And then during the week, I always bug people. What happened to such and such?
So you wander in the lab?
I wander sometimes.
Okay.
And then we have lab meetings twice a week with journal clubs, mm-hmm. you know, at 8:45 in the morning on Monday, mm-hmm. followed by 2 half-an-hour talks by 2 individuals in the laboratory on their science. Okay. And then a second journal club on Friday where we do a second journal club. Mm-hmm. In addition to all the other department seminars and division seminars that we have. So each individual has usually 1 to 2 projects, usually one, their major project, which is probably the higher risk project, and sort of a second backup project. And they usually try to balance the two mm-hmm. depending how each project is going. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The technicians likewise also have some projects of their own. Either some crazy idea I have and they're just testing it out to see whether there's anything to it, or they're actually there's certain projects that have been going on in the wild in the laboratory that are fairly straightforward that we just need to crank out the data for.
Right.
So that's pretty much how I run my lab from week to week.
And what about this business? Because, you know, you get 12 people together, uh-huh. and there's going to be all kinds of politics and things uh-huh. going on. So,
I have 2 rooms.
So you just separate warring parties
no.
or what?
I mean, I think by and large, this has happened, you know, where mm-hmm. clearly there are certain personality differences that just are never going to get resolved. Mm-hmm. And usually... what I end up having to do is sit both of them down and say, look, you're both professionals. You're both adults. Mm-hmm. This isn't grade mm-hmm. school. So either one, you act professionally, mm-hmm. or two, you're going to have to leave. Because, you know, somebody like that can be extremely detrimental yeah. to the entire laboratory. So... that's the way I try to handle it. Mm-hmm. It's not easy because you really don't want to interfere with certain, because lots of times certain things would take the course.
Yeah.
And you hate to have to intervene with every single incident mm-hmm. that happens. Mm-hmm. But when it starts affecting the general morale or general operation of the laboratory, mm-hmm. then you have to intercede.
Mm-hmm. So this will be my last question okay. for the day, mm-hmm. but what kind of a boss are you? That you have 30 uh-huh. seconds uh-huh. now.
I'm an extremely demanding boss.
Are you?
Okay. I expect that certain things be done at a certain pace. Mm-hmm. I expect people to be able to think about what they're doing, mm-hmm. be able to troubleshoot what they're doing, and be able to plan the experiment beforehand to walk themselves through the experiment, to be able to come up with a reasonable experiment. Mm-hmm. Okay, now that's not to say that I expect them to do that from day one. Mm-hmm. You know, graduate students are graduate students. Postdocs still require training, mm-hmm. though I expect them to be a little bit more advanced in their ability sure. to go through this kind of process. And so, for the graduate students, it's extremely important to me that by the time they finish, that they're going to be outstanding and rigorous scientists. And as I tell them, I don't want the person that they're going to end up working for calling me and going, who is this that you sent me? They're not trained. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely important to me that my students, as well as my trainees, know how to do that. Mm-hmm. And I will tell, you know, I've told the students and trainees that mm-hmm. I will tell whoever calls me that I'm going to tell it as it is, because mm-hmm. it's not fair to the other people mm-hmm. that can do that mm-hmm. for me to cover for them mm-hmm. or to not exactly tell them exactly how good or what their strengths and weaknesses are. So from that standpoint, I'm extremely demanding. I think I am supportive. Okay, if they have a, you know, they have a certain situation, I'm more than happy to listen to it and try to help them come to some resolution, how to get around or how to resolve the problem, whether it be a personal problem, whether it's an academic problem, whether it's a scientific problem. I'm willing to expend whatever energies, monies, or anything else to try to help them in any one of those capacities. Because I think from an ethical and moral view, I have taken them under sort of, they're my responsibility. And but at the same time, I expect them to uphold their part of the bargain that they will make themselves as best of an individual that they can. So from that standpoint, I'm extremely demanding.
Okay. Well, we're going to stop because I know you have to go to a meeting, and we'll pick up on Thursday.
Okay.